Catholic Answers Live, Hour 2. I am Chris Check, president of Catholic Answers. My guest, I am sitting in for Cy Kellett, and my guest today, super apologist at Catholic Answers. You have a title, staff apologist. Yes. I've always thought staff apologist was kind of, I don't know, it's sort of...
It's like someone you picked up at a call center. Like, yeah, this, you want to be our staff apologist? We got a cubicle over here for you if you want to do that.
Yes, it's like you're the apologist for the staff.
Oh, yes.
If any of the staff have questions.
If anyone only here at 2020 Gillespie has a question, they go to my cubicle.
And you answer questions for the staff.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Like the staff copyist, the staff editor.
Right.
I guess, yeah, why wouldn't it, is it redundant? Should I just be the Trent Horn Catholic Answers apologist?
Yeah, yeah. I like super apologists.
I'm quite happy to have that. We know, well, Jimmy's the senior apologist, we have to see how senior is going to, I think, rank above super.
Super, yeah. And then, like, Carlo could be awesome apologist. I think this, we have to have a focus group on this. But just to be clear, you are not the kind of staff apologist that you need penicillin to get rid of.
No, right? I am not a Staphylococcus apologist.
Okay, Staphylococcus apologist.
That's what, if some new disease comes from here, I think that's what we should call it. So, or if we discover it, like let's say myself and Jimmy, we have all kinds of esoteric other hobbies.
Right.
On Jimmy Akin's podcast, Mysterious World, he talks about the weird, paranormal, and the strange. On Council of Trent, my podcast, which you can check out, Council of Trent on iTunes podcast app. I have theology Tuesdays and Thursdays. Friday are free for all events. You never know what I'll end up talking about on Fridays. But hey, maybe if we get in a hobby and discover some new bacterium here, we'll call it Staphylococcus apologist, you know,
yeah.
Staph apologist.
Okay. I hope it doesn't shut down the economy.
Well, maybe we'll be able to derive some life-saving treatment from it, much as like happened with penicillin.
Right.
You never know.
Yeah, from like some citrus fruit that went bad.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, whether it's loaves of bread or orange or whatever, maybe. Well, I'll check the fridge now. Just tell Emily to stop cleaning the fridge on Fridays because maybe the key to the next healthcare development is waiting in there to mold.
You know, that's Emily Sanchez, my awesome, super awesome assistant, super awesome assistant, Emily Sanchez. There are some things, Trent, that I can tell her to do. And then there are many things I cannot. And I don't think I can morally tell Emily not to clean the fridge on Fridays.
Might also, given the state of California, you legally can't do that. There's lots of things with health code here. We can't even walk down most of the hallways here in certain directions.
Unless you're following the arrows.
Follow the arrows.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, now I know that our friend on Facebook, Patrick, is saying, when is Chris going to get to the questions? I wonder if he's typed that yet.
We will find out.
888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. The show is Catholic Answers Live. I am Chris Check. My guest is Trent Horn. And the topic this hour is the same as it was last hour. Which Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Let's go to Gene in West Hartford, Connecticut. Gene, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, yes. I have forever grappled with the idea of people burning in hell for an eternity. I'm not sure if that's what you're talking about, but I was raised Catholic, switched over to the Baptist church, and the Baptists kind of teach that purgatory that the Catholics teach is, which is a nice thought, isn't really in the Bible.
Okay.
All right.
So I don't know if I'm on the right topic here, but I just really struggle with a loving God sending someone to burn for eternity in hell.
All right, Trent, hell, is it forever?
Well, here's what the Catechism says, and then maybe we can chat about your discomfort with it. The Catechism of the Catholic Church says in paragraph 1035, the teaching of the Church affirms the existence of hell and its eternity. Immediately after death, the souls of those who die in a state of mortal sin descend into hell, where they suffer the punishments of hell, eternal fire, and that is in quotation marks in the Catechism. The chief punishment of hell is eternal separation from God, in whom alone man can possess the life and happiness for which he was created and for which he longs. So, and Pope St. John Paul II has also talked about this, that the Bible's descriptions of hell, just like its descriptions of heaven, are images that are used for us to understand the afterlife, but it hasn't been fully revealed to us. So the Church does not teach about what the literal nature of hell is, whether it involves literal fire, because other images of hell that are used in the Bible seem to contradict this. For example, Jesus also talks about hell being an outer darkness, but we know the fire generates light. So that would seem contradictory there. When we see that, once again, you know, heaven, we talk about heaven being like banquets and other elements like that, that are not necessarily literal descriptions of heaven. There are other descriptions of hell that may not be literal. But what we do know that is literal, what we do know that is literal about hell, that's even more scary than the idea of fire, is the idea of spending eternity apart from God, who is the source of all goodness. Gene, what I would say here is I agree with you. I also would not be able to understand a God who sends people to hell who desire to spend eternity with him, who through people through no fault of their own, God makes them, and then he sends them to hell. Calvinists believe in something like this called double predestination, and that God chooses who goes to heaven and who goes to hell. Catholics reject that absolutely and unequivocally. God doesn't send anyone to hell. However, God does want us to be free. God is love, 1 John 4:8. And love has to be free. Love is not love if it's forced, and it's kidnapping, and it's Stockholm syndrome, and it's unpleasant. So God is love, and he lets us freely choose to love him, which also means he freely lets people reject him. So that could involve people, if they choose to reject God and goodness in this life, they may reject him for all eternity as well, and God will not force them into a loving relationship with him in heaven. So that's where hell comes about, that hell is not something that God made per se. It's more something that we made with our sins. So I'm happy to dialogue with you more about this because I know it's a very contentious subject. But before we continue, do you see what I'm saying about the difference between God doesn't send people to hell, he allows people to choose to reject him? Do you see how there'd be a difference between those two things?
Yes, as long as, I guess, people are aware of him. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it sounds like, Gene, would you agree there could be some cases where it would make sense for God to allow someone to be damned, like someone who loves evil and says, I hate God, I'm going to do what I want, commits horrible deeds, like they're a serial killer, they're a rapist, a racist murderer. They're a very, very bad person who says they hate God and they want to live their life however they want to. So it might make sense in that case. It would make sense in that case for God to let that person be separated from him for all eternity. So like in some cases, would you say hell makes sense?
I would still have a hard time saying that like eternity,
sure,
eternal damnation is warranted.
Right. And I think
I would think maybe just annihilation.
Okay, well, that is a different view, because I think that if these people exist, so it sounds like you wouldn't accept universalism, that everybody goes to heaven, because if you have the rape...
Right, exactly. That doesn't make sense.
Okay, yeah. And so that is another view, the idea that, well, would God just simply annihilate these people? Is it wrong for him to allow people to exist eternally apart from him? And I would say that it's not wrong for God to do that. I would say that the two objections here, well, the main objection would be God is allowing an eternal consequence for a temporal decision. But I don't think that it's the case that God is giving eternity merely because of what somebody does just in this life. One way to look at it is that God gives us the opportunity to choose him in this life. In the next life, our wills become fixed. Or at the very least, what will happen for these people who are damned is that the reason hell is eternal is not because God makes it so. It's that they continue to reject God and become more and more fixed in their ways. It's kind of like, it's interesting, Gene, when I've met people in life who reach advanced age, 70, 80, or 90, and I'm sure, Chris, you probably had this experience. I think sometimes we see that people reach an extreme version of character seeds that they sowed in their 20s or 30s. Mm-hmm. So someone who practiced generosity and meekness and bravery and kindness as a young person, they're just the sweetest elderly person you could meet.
I had an old friend who used to say people become more like themselves the older they get.
Yes. And then there are some elderly people that the title cranks are applied to them. Mm-hmm. Curmudgeoned is another word, that the seeds of vice and hatred they sowed as young people, now they're able to hide it because as a young person, you can be charming and you might be able to navigate the social realms.
Are you saying old people aren't charming? Is this where this is going here, Trent?
No, what I'm saying is that they may get the point of they don't feel like putting up the facade anymore.
Right.
That when you're younger, you have to put up a facade to advance in your career, to get married. But then when you reach a certain age in life, you say, I don't care anymore. I'm just going to speak what's on my mind, and that's that. And so I think that sometimes, Gene, that then people become more, if they become more and more themselves, imagine you live eternally and God respects your existence. He respects that you exist and your free choices, and he allows you to live, and you just become more of that. And so for all eternity, that damned person, one element of good, you say, well, how does good come from that? Well, they serve forever as a sign of God's justice. They forever exist as a sign of the justice of God and of his mercy towards sinners who he has saved, who could not save themselves from that fate. So there is some good that can still come from that. Gene, what I would recommend, though, well, let's get your email address. I will send you some resources. First, my friend and colleague Carla Broussard just published an article on Catholic Answers Magazine online about why an eternal hell, or an everlasting hell, I should say, is not unjust. And I have also done articles on annihilationism, that when it comes to the nature of hell, we can have our thoughts about it, but we should also just go back to divine revelation and what God tells us about it. So give us your email address to the call screener. I'll send you some of my resources on annihilationism and why the Bible does not teach that, as well as other resources on the nature of hell. But I'm grateful that you called, and I hope you'll call back again sometime.
Thanks very much, Gene. Let's go to Anonymous. Anonymous, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, Mr. Horn.
Hi.
Hi. I think it's the first time you and I are talking, but that's not here nor there.
Sure.
Okay, I do have a question concerning morality, but it's theological in nature. So I'm going to read two verses, okay?
Okay.
Out of Matthew chapter 5.
Okay.
So it says here, just part of chapter verse 22. So it says here, you fool, and whoever says you fool shall be guilty enough to go into fiery hell.
Uh-huh.
And it says here, verse 28, but everyone who looks at a woman lusts after her and has already committed adultery with her in his heart.
That's right. Yes.
So if, now I take the first passage as implying a murderous heart. So that is, if that is equated with murder, as in sufficient to go to the lake of fire,
right?
At least the guilt of it. And if I lust in my heart to commit adultery, because I'm thinking in my brain, and that I think every normal man, every normal Roman Catholic deals with this every day, why is it not a mortal sin?
Why is what not a mortal sin? I'm not sure if I...
The deliberate desire to commit adultery, why is the deliberate desire to commit adultery not a mortal sin, even if you don't act on it? Is that what you're asking, Anonymous?
Correct. So it's a thank you, sir. So it's adultery in my heart and murder in my heart, such that I call a person fool, you fool. So,
right.
Which is sufficient to have guilt. So why would not that? Why would not those things not be a mortal sin? Why would it not be a mortal sin?
Well, what the church teaches when we look at the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, and the ninth, well, this is really involving three commandments here. The fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill. The sixth commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. And the ninth commandment, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, covet your neighbor's wife. They all move together here. And what the church does teach is that sinful anger can be mortal, and sinfully dwelling on lustful thoughts is a grave matter. The church teaches when it comes to something being a mortal sin, there are three conditions that are required. It has to be grave matter. It has to be something that you fully know that it is a grave matter. You have full knowledge of the sin involved, and you fully intend or cooperate with the sin in nature. That you're not, it's not coerced. You're freely choosing it. Those three elements are what makes something a mortal sin. So the church does not teach that certain behaviors are mortal sins, because two of the elements involved are subjective. They depend on the person. The church does teach that several things are grave matter. Something can be grave matter just because of what it is. And so what the church teaches about grave matter is that it involves typically a violation of the commandments. And so the catechism talks about how sinful anger, dwelling not even necessarily on murderous thoughts, but dwelling on thoughts in your mind of desiring malice towards your neighbor, to dwell on that and to be fixated upon it, that's grave matter. To dwell on lustful thoughts towards committing adultery or fornication. The catechism condemns lust in paragraph 2351, and then it talks about the ninth commandment in paragraphs 2514 through 2516. So the church does say that this kind of dwelling on these thoughts is a grave matter. We have to just be careful to distinguish that from passing thoughts, that there are always going to be, we are fallen creatures. There are going to be disordered thoughts that pop into our mind all the time. It's kind of like popcorn kernels in the machine. Like, they're going to pop and pop out of there and be the popcorn. The question is, are we going to eat the popcorn or are we going to throw it in the trash? I don't know if that's a great analogy. It was the first thing that popped in my head. But the thoughts pop up like the kernel of popcorn. We can't control where the thoughts emanate. We can control whether we dwell on them or not. And to dwell on them or fixate upon either sinful anger or sinful lust, the church does teach that that is grave matter. And that can lead to a mortal sin and separate us from God. So we must seek purity of heart and purity of mind is a very difficult thing to do. That is why frequent reception of the sacraments, confession, reconciliation, Eucharist, and prayer are so vital as we struggle against the sins of the flesh, what St. John calls lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So I hope that's helpful for you, and I'm grateful you called in.
Anonymous, we got to go to break. Trent, I would add fasting to that
yes.
list also. My friends, have you read the award-winning Catholic Answers magazine? If you have not, why not? Well, here's a great opportunity. You're going to love it. We've packaged digital copies of Catholic Answers magazine so that you can get the past year's issues for less than $10 a year, or you can get 8 years worth of digital magazine issues for $39.95. That's 48 issues of Catholic Answers magazine for $39.95. That comes out to $5 a year. What a bargain. Visit the ebook and magazine section at shop.catholic.com and check out our new offerings. That's shop.catholic.com. Right back after this.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Every single day, I get to help our listeners of the Sunrise Morning Show wake up, find out what's going on in the church and the world, and then walk with them as we all seek to grow in knowledge and love of Jesus Christ and the Catholic faith. I mean, how could it get any better?
The Sunrise Morning Show with Anna Mitchell and Matt Swaim. Tomorrow morning, 6 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Truth, Catholic Answers Live. I am Chris Check, sitting in for Cy Kellett. The topic today, what Catholic moral teaching do you reject? To help you with your question, awesome apologist Trent Horn. Let's go to John in Huntington Beach, California, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. John, thanks for putting the CI Live app on your phone. What's your question for Trent?
Oh, yeah, thank you. Well, I guess my question would be about morality, biblical morality, and the foundation of God's morality. But look, say an ancient Israelite woman living under the Mosaic Law a couple thousand years ago, 2,500, 3,000 years ago, was tired of, you know, just tired of the blood of killing doves and killing goats and sprinkling their blood on the altar and burning their corpses and burnt offerings. And she went to her husband and her children and people in the village that she was living and said, I don't want to worship that God anymore. I'm just tired of all the death and the blood. I want to worship the sun that greets me every morning and provides me with the light that I see my children with. And it provides the flowers that I find so beautiful. It ends the day for me in a beautiful sunset. I want to worship the sun. And she goes around trying to convince other people to worship the sun as well. It's pretty clear in Deuteronomy 13 and then again in Deuteronomy 17 that she has to be put on trial. If two or three people testify to her trying to get them to worship a god other than the god of the Israelite people, that she used to be taken to the edge of the village and stoned to death. Mm-hmm. It says that her husband is supposed to cast the first stone, and he's to show her no mercy. And
okay,
no-
so John, it sounds like you object to the Old Testament's teaching that purposely leading people away from worshiping the true God is a capital offense. So you don't like that was a teaching in the Old Testament, or you disagree with that?
No, that's a misstatement. What I don't like is this woman's practicing her religious freedom. I think we can all agree that religious freedom is a fact, that we have that. It's a moral fact. That's all she's doing. And the God of the Catholic faith insists that she be stoned to death. Let's talk a little bit about stoning someone to death.
We have a good image of what stoning is, but we're trying to understand exactly what's your question.
John, what's your question?
Would you stone that person to death if you were an ancient Israelite living under the Mosaic law? Do you affirm that conduct? Would you do it personally yourself?
How does a Catholic reconcile these passages in the Mosaic law, Trent?
Mm-hmm. So, John, what I would do is I would always... Here's a principle that I would follow, and I'm curious if you would follow this. I would always follow the commands that an all-knowing and all-good God gives me. Would you do the same?
I'm sorry, I did speak over you, so I missed your question. I apologize.
I would follow the commands that an all-good God who created the universe, who is the sum of perfection itself, I would follow the commands of that which is perfection itself. Would you do the same?
No, I wouldn't, because it's not perfection. Would you do it if it was your own wife? Would you stone your own wife
okay.
to death?
John, you're saying that it is a fact that it is wrong to execute someone because they practice a certain religion?
I think that is certainly an American fact, that we have religious freedom. I'm going on American values, not the values of the God that you worship. Mm-hmm. You still haven't answered my question. It sounds like you would, that you would, in fact, stone your own wife to death, because that is, in fact, what the God of the Old Testament in Deuteronomy 13 and again in 17 demands that you do if she tries to get you to worship the sun, which is really not that bad.
Would you have a problem if this woman was telling people she wants them to worship the sun, and the best way to do that is to sacrifice their children, which happened frequently in antiquity?
Well, that's a different thing altogether. I would have a huge problem with that, obviously, but that's
why?
Not the situation that we have.
Why isn't that religious freedom, John?
Well, no, John, she's practicing her religious freedom. And that was very common in religions of that time, to sacrifice their children to the sun or to other deities. Should they be free to practice their religious freedom?
Even in the United States, religious freedom has its limits. That's murder. So we don't allow people to murder other people and then use religious freedom as an excuse for that. So no, it wouldn't be.
Would it be okay if we as a country changed our laws and allowed a religious freedom exemption for sacrificing children? If we just changed the law, just like other things, we've changed the law before on slavery and segregation and same-sex marriage. If we changed the law and allowed sacrificing children to sun worshipers, deities, if that was then an American fact and law, would there be anything wrong with it?
Yes, I would be totally opposed to that. I would fight that. I would fight that with everything that I had in me.
John, how do you know it's wrong? How do you know it's wrong?
I believe the Constitution of the United States is pretty clear that, you know, the mantra of American values is that...
So it sounds like your basis of morality flows from whatever American law and the Constitution says.
Okay, so you've moved these goalposts, you've built a straw man for me to argue against. You haven't really answered my question, but the fact is...
Fine, I'll answer your question. Yeah, I would carry out, if I was in ancient Israel, I would carry out God's law, and I would enact capital punishment against those who broke God's law. And if they very well know the law, don't you think people should be held accountable? So there, I've answered your question. I know you find that repugnant, but I believe your view is the repugnant one, because you have no standard for morality. So my question for you is, does morality, your source of morality, is it an American legal document? Is that your source of what makes things right or wrong?
Yes, it's called the Bill of Rights in the United States Constitution. I'm a little bit, you know, to say that I don't have a source of morality because I don't believe in stoning my own family members to death is a little bit...
So, John, then here's my question. Does the Constitution have amendments?
Yes, it does.
Do the amendments all have equal force?
Well, that gets interpreted by the courts, and it gets very complicated, but that would be the American standard of morality is what we have.
All 27 amendments, right? Is it what, 27?
The biblical standard of reality.
John, okay, here's what, well, I think we have to let you go, because here's the problem. If you added that 28th amendment for child sacrifice, you would be against it, which shows you have a universal standard of morality beyond our Constitution, a law above laws that can only be rooted in a universal and transcendent God. So in trying to undermine God with morality, you've actually used morality to prove God does exist.
Catholic Answers Live, right back after this.
Your number one source for Catholic apologetics and evangelization, Catholic Answers Live.
What are the basics of Jewish belief and practice? How does modern Judaism differ from the Hebrew religion of the Old Testament? Is Christianity to blame for historic anti-Semitism and for not doing enough to stop the Holocaust? Judaism is the ancient foundation of Christianity, yet many Catholics remain ignorant of its beliefs. 20 Answers Judaism dispels that ignorance with a helpful overview of Judaism's history, its forms of worship, and sources of doctrine and more. 20 Answers Judaism is part of the 20 Answer series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
About 30 minutes left with Trent Horn. What Catholic moral teaching do you reject? Trent, assistant producer Marie had a good question for our previous caller there.
Yes, she did. That he was very offended at the idea of the ancient Israelites administering capital punishment towards those who would lead Israel astray and violating religious freedom. And we asked, well, what is your source of that moral standard? And he appealed to the American principles of freedom of religion. But then by that standard, how could ancient Israel be held accountable to a moral standard that arose 3,500 years later after the fact, or 3,000 years later?
That poor Israelite woman didn't have the American Constitution to turn to.
So how could he judge the people of that time according to a moral standard that didn't exist? And I think it shows that if you try to place your moral standard in these transitory elements that change, you can't ground morality successfully. So I thought it was interesting there in that discussion that what people will do sometimes is they'll look at the Old Testament and try to denigrate it according to their own moral standards. And yet their own moral standards don't actually have any support whatsoever.
Right.
And so that leads to the problem of your moral foundations. If you're going to treat them as a fact that is binding upon everyone, where is the ultimate source of that fact, and where does it come from?
And correct me if I'm wrong, the words freedom of religion or religious freedom do not in fact appear in the American Constitution. Now, there is something about the establishment of a national religion.
Yeah, so the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion,
right,
or preventing the free exercise thereof. So essentially what that means is the U.S. promised we wouldn't make a national church, which was very common in England at the time.
Right. Though the various states had what you might describe as national churches.
Yes, although the Constitution does have provisions that prevent requiring religious tests for oaths of office and other things like that. However, later in the U.S. Supreme Court history, this was a case, Reynolds versus the United States in the 19th century, involving Mormon polygamists. And where the Supreme Court ruled that religious freedom is not unlimited because the Mormons, this is prior to their first revelation, God said polygamy was okay at the beginning with Brigham, right, Young and Joseph Smith, and Mormons believe in progressive revelation. So then God later told their president that no, polygamy is not okay, at around the same time the U.S. government was cracking down on them for practicing polygamy. So what the court, Reynolds versus the U.S. said that no, religious freedom cannot be unlimited. If it were, every man would be a law unto himself.
Right.
Now, interesting here on this gentleman's objection to capital punishment being administered for leading people astray in blasphemy. There are, of course, other issues I was not able to get into to fine tune with this gentleman. It was more of a contentious engagement, if you will. Because if I had time, I would point out multiple factors, such as I do in my book, Hard Sayings, A Catholic Approach to Answering Bible Difficulties. First, it may be the case that these punishments, they are described in Scripture, but they're not always carried out, rarely or never carried out, that they're meant as a kind of warning. They're a maximum penalty meant for a particularly flagrant violation of the law. It's kind of like when you play a DVD or the old VHS tapes, it would say, if you copy this tape, yes, 5 years in prison and $250,000. And I would sit there when I was a kid. I'm like, so if I make a copy of Home Alone, I'm gonna end up in prison for 5 years? No, they save that punishment for the most flagrant copyright violators. They just have to put it on there. So there are cases where we're not sure how this case law was applied in ancient Israel. Number two, when you look at this, in our modern culture, we often don't understand. We talk about the virtues of religious freedom. That was built upon religion being the backbone of society to give us a stable society in the first place. That people think that religion nowadays is just an accessory to life, whereas throughout most of human history up until the modern age, it was a central element of civilization. That to undermine it was essentially treason.
Yes.
And so we understand that even today in the United States, treason is a capital punishment. Treason is a capital offense. If you commit treason against the United States, if you put U.S. national security in jeopardy, if you sold secrets to our enemies or something like that, if you were a spy, you could be executed. And we hold that as a firm punishment because it's something that can risk people's lives and welfare. Well, then you have to go back 3,500 years to ancient Israel wandering in the desert amongst foreign tribes out to destroy them, either through active warfare or by leading them away from the true God and into idolatrous, murderous, sexually disordered practices.
Beelphegor, or however it is you say that.
Baal Peor?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yes. So worshiping Baal Peor, Molech. And so what he's talking about here is like, oh, they just worship the sun. And it's like, no, in my book, Hard Sayings, I talk about how the Canaanites engaged in child sacrifice by fire. Leviticus is very clear. It tells the Israelites, do not send your children through fire to Molech. It has to put it there plainly. And now some biblical scholars, Chris, have said, well, the Israelites were making that up to justify invading Canaan. But no, we have discovered in Carthage and in other areas, we have found deposits that include the bones of toddlers
and
fetuses.
They call them the Tophets.
Yes. Yeah. So we found... Now, and it's not a graveyard because we've also found significant amounts of charcoal,
right,
which shows that these, and they're also Plutarch. Plutarch gives us a brutal description of one of these sacrifices where the child is placed in the bronze arms of the statue.
And falls into the fire.
And the fire leaps up and the child writhes about and falls. It's just horrible things. And that's what is happening here. And that people don't understand that they take it for granted that we now live in a time where you can call 911 and someone on the other end will come and help you if there's a problem. But if we I'm getting into my conspiracy theory mode here, but things would be very different. We would have a better understanding of what ancient Israel went through if one of our enemies were to detonate a high-altitude electromagnetic pulse device. Imagine one day we have the world it is now, and then the next day...
No communications.
Your lights don't work. Your cell phone doesn't work. Water doesn't come out of the tap. Right. The internet doesn't turn on.
Right.
You would start to see people... What would happen in that situation is people would come together in clans and gangs, and there would be a very harsh form of punishment and justice that would be meted out for pure survival. And then people would start to see what ancient Israelites and others had to go through, which is why God's revelation in the Old Testament, as Pope Benedict said in his apostolic exhortation, Verbum Domini, is a progressive one leading people ultimately to the moral ideals that we find in Jesus Christ.
You know, Trent, in my forthcoming course for the School of Apologetics that will be out this fall on the Inquisition, or Inquisitions, I should say. I start with Moses, all right, the first inquisitor, you might say. But I address this very question that there was a time when religion was so central to the social life that people regarded heresy as treasonous.
Yeah. Right.
To say nothing of threatening someone's immortal
soul.
Yeah,
If it's murder to kill the body, what about killing the soul?
Right.
And then I have to work now on my forthcoming book about evangelization in the apocalypse. I'm going to call it Be the Light of Christ When the Lights Go Out Forever.
I think we'll sell a lot of copies of those. Of course, how are we going to sell them if we don't have... You know, shop.catholic.com.
We got to get them out now. Right. So before it hits, we need to do that.
John in Kansas City, Missouri, on KEXS. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you, guys. I'm looking for a Catholic answer to this argument.
Okay.
That is used by 75% of couples, that a couple can make the judgment using their conscience that something that has been defined as objectively and intrinsically evil, like contraception, can be used permissibly in the sight of God because their conscience is inviolable. In Humanae Vitae Castae Connubii, in centuries of Christian teaching, is doctrine and not dogma.
Sure. Okay. So the objection is my conscience, I must always follow my conscience, and if the teaching on contraception has not been infallibly defined, I am free to not follow that teaching. Now, when it comes, let's settle straight what the teaching, Church's teaching on conscience is. In paragraph 1790 of the Catechism, the Church teaches, a human being must always obey the certain judgment of his conscience. If he were deliberately to act against it, he would condemn himself. Yet, it can happen that moral conscience remains in ignorance and makes erroneous judgments about acts to be performed or already committed. And so the error here is, I would bring to that person's attention that this is a matter not even so much of conscience about morality, what one ought to do, but understanding ecclesiology and theology, which is what the Church teaches. And so as Catholics, we are obliged to obey the Church's teachings, not just those that have been infallibly defined. Now, there are moral theologians who say that the teaching on contraception has been infallibly defined, and there are others who say that it has not. But even if it has not been infallibly defined, most of the Church's teachings have not been given to us with an infallible definition. And yet we are required to give those teachings the religious submission of mind and will, and so to act against them. Act against them in our private lives, so to not follow them. So, for example, the Church's teaching on IVF has not been, in vitro fertilization has not been infallibly defined, but it would be a sin to procure a embryo through IVF. It's a sin to violate the Church's teachings that are not infallibly defined. They require the religious submission of mind and will. I point to in the Church's teachings where it says that we have to obey them, at the very least obey them, and not counsel others to disobey them. So there, that argument from conscience doesn't fly, where I would say, okay, you have this judgment of your conscience. How do you square it with these two teachings? One, we must give religious submission of mind and will to what the Church teaches, and the Church teaches the contraception is sinful. So you have this judgment of your conscience, but how in the world could your conscience not be in error when it clearly violates these two clear teachings of what we must obey and then what the church prohibits us from doing. So I would recommend that as an option. And also, if you would like to go deeper into the subject of what the church teaches, I would recommend my friend Jimmy Akin's book, Teaching with Authority, by Jimmy Akin, Teaching with Authority. It goes into great detail on these questions. You may find it to be very helpful.
888-318-7884. My friends, we all would like to be as adept as Trent is at answering moral questions. Well, here's how you can begin to prepare yourself to be. Evidence for Catholic Moral Teaching, What the Church Teaches on Right and Wrong, is a full-length course from the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics taught by Trent Horn. There are 60 easy-to-watch video segments and a study guide, online quizzes. You can take the course at your own pace. Abortion, euthanasia, homosexuality, just war, embryo ethics, human cloning, contraception, pornography, divorce and remarriage, etc., etc. So if you want to get good at answering these moral and ethical questions, then sign up for this course, Evidence for Catholic Moral Teaching, What the Church Teaches on Right and Wrong. How do I do that? Visit schoolofapologetics.com today. Oh, wait, Trent, we're offering an introductory price that saves you $30 off if you sign up right now. But this price won't last forever.
Well, sign up.
Nothing's going to last forever. But
except for the new heaven and new earth. Nothing we have here as it is will last forever.
I think that this deal is going to go away sooner than a lot of other things.
That's right. So you'll want to sign up now. It's a course I think that you'll enjoy. So definitely check out our Catholic Answers School of Apologetics, Evidence for Catholic Moral Teaching. And then also very, very soon, coming up, sneak preview, I have a new course that'll be out soon. So we'll let everyone know when it comes out. And that course is called Creation from Nothing?
Wow.
And so it's a defense of the church's teaching on creation.
Our School of Apologetics is awesome.
It really is.
It's fantastic. Congratulations to the guys in the video department and press and Jimmy Akin, who's the dean of it, and the apologists who are the teachers and the IT guys who found the platform. It was a real team effort here. Schoolofapologetics.com, right back after this.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
He was a mystic and reformer who died at the age of 33.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Catherine of Siena accomplished something no one thought possible. She convinced Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome after the popes had lived in France for almost the whole of the 14th century. They've been there ever since.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Catholic Answers Live, 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. I am Chris Check, sitting in for Cy Kellett, my guest, Trent Horn. Just about 12 minutes left here, Trent. Let's see if we can knock out these remaining calls.
Yes. Before we do, I want to give a special shout-out, though. I got the special present in the mail for me, the Word on Fire Bible.
Oh, from our friends at Word on Fire.
Yes. I really enjoy it. It's quite
it's
a
very
Bible.
Handsome. I have to say, all their stuff is very good-looking.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah, they have an aesthetic sense up there at Word on Fire.
Quite photogenic, indeed.
Yeah.
This one is the Gospels. So, I mean, you could see it's the Gospels, but it's almost as thick as a New Testament or even an entire Bible. But it's beautifully bound, has a lot of commentary from Bishop Barron. It's just really a treat. So I'm really glad that they sent this to me. And I highly recommend it for others. Go definitely check out the Word on Fire Bible with the Gospels. You won't be disappointed.
This is the thing I think we can praise our friends at Word on Fire for, maybe even most for. They understand that beauty is a way to draw people back to Jesus.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Truth, beauty, and goodness. And I think that we here at Catholic Answers, we spend a lot of time on the truth element. Right. I mean, look at this show. We're going through arguments, logical premises, inferences, and that's good. And people need to do that. And there are rational ways to coming to believe in God and His church. But Chris, sometimes I worry that the people think that's the only way.
Right.
And that the Holy Spirit can work through people in a variety of ways. So I believe there are rational, but also non-rational ways, not irrational. That'd be opposed to reason.
Right.
But I believe that if somebody goes to St. Chapelle's in Paris and prays the Hail Mary and stands and is flooded in light under the stained glass window and feels the Holy Spirit moving within them, I think that's a very valid way to come to believe in the reality of God apart from formal arguments.
Those are some of the most spectacular windows
beautiful.
In the world, in the St. Chapelle, built by St. Louis to house the crown of thorns.
Which St.? Oh, yeah, by St. Louis.
King St. Louis.
King St. Louis.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully if his statue gets torn down, they can take it back to St. Chapelle.
Yeah.
He can't stay up here. I think I remember when I was there, the one thing that struck out at me, you go to Notre Dame and it's huge. I remember St. Chapelle being quite small, actually.
It's
tiny.
It's kind of around the corner there. They're both on the Ile there.
And also speaking of St. Louis, on the Ile de St. Louis, there is a wonderful ice cream shop named Bertoli's. If you're ever in Paris, you won't be disappointed.
That sounds like it's run by an Irishman, Bertoli's.
Yeah, but it is. I went there with my wife on our honeymoon. Line was out the door, waited like a half hour. It's completely worth it. When we also went to dinner, we got reservations at 7 o'clock, only people in the restaurant. So like the Parisians like to start their dinners, I think, at like 9:30. And so
I have two places in Paris that I love. One is on the Rue de Bac. That's the Miraculous Metal Chapel there, right? Where it all happened. And you go in there that you see very few Parisians. You always see lots of very devout, Filipino nuns or something there praying.
Yes.
The heart of Vincent de Paul. But then also not far from there on the Rue Vaugirard is the Convent of the Carme, where in the September massacres in 1789, all those priests were hauled in by the sans-culottes, and they turned the sanctuary into a revolutionary court, and they brought the priests in two by two and said, will you sign for the new revolutionary or national church? And to a man, the priest said, no, we will not sign, and they cut him to pieces. And if you go in the refectory, which is on the second floor above the church there, you can see where the sans-culottes rested in the middle of the slaughter and to have lunch, and they put their swords on the side of the wall, and the bloodstains of the martyrs there are preserved behind glass there. It's very moving.
Wow, that is moving. Yeah. I will only add one more sight. If you go to the Champ d'Elysees by the Arc de Triomphe, you go down there, you will find the fanciest McDonald's in the world on the Champ d'Elysees. It is very classy, and they give you breadsticks instead of French fries. Champ d'Elysees, fanciest McDonald's you ever been in, I guarantee it.
Isn't that Champs-Élysées? I think my French is a lot better than yours.
Oh, that is quite possible.
Yeah, well, I learned
indeed.
I learned
indeed.
French from Peter Sellers movies.
Ah, yes.
Let's go to Claire in Ohio, listening on Ave Maria Radio. Claire, welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, thank you, gentlemen. I have a question. Thank you for doing this topic, because I have a question. I have been struggling with this for a long time, and it's the Catholic Church's stance on illegal immigration.
Sure.
And I'm just going to make a few points and then see what your answer is. But, this is the most generous, welcoming country in the world. Mm-hmm. However, I feel like if we don't take care of our own people, and there's no doubt that we are not taking care of our own people, because you just have to look around at the homeless and the drug addicted and the veterans that are in bad shape, then we can't be strong for anybody else. And the these people that have come in droves, there has been no chance to vet most of these people. And I understand that some people are fleeing persecution.
Are you referring to people who go through the legal process of immigrating to the country, or those who come here apart from the legal process and would be illegal immigrants?
Illegal, the ones that jump the fence.
Okay.
as opposed to those who are trying to come in the legal way and spending years and thousands of dollars because they're trying to do it the right way.
Okay. Claire, I'm gonna let Trent help unpack exactly what it is the church does and does not teach about immigration, illegal or otherwise.
Right, and I think the best place for you to go would be paragraph 2241 of the Catechism. It summarizes it very well there. It says, the more prosperous nations are obliged, to the extent they are able, to welcome the foreigner in search of the security and the means of livelihood which he cannot find in his country of origin. Public authorities should see to it that the natural right is respected that places a guest under the protection of those who receive him. And so what that would mean for those of us living here in the United States is that we believe that there is as Catholics, we believe there is a general right to allow people who seek migration for us to welcome them. A country should welcome them. Notice the Catechism says, to the extent they are able. So the point that you raise, Claire, about, you know, what if a country can't, quote unquote, take care of its own, that would be a prudential judgment. That doesn't contradict what the church teaches. People may disagree about the precise number of immigrants every year that a country is capable of assimilating. But I think everyone agrees on that principle. And the church agrees that nations, that there could be a case where a nation is unable to, especially a very small nation, may not be able to welcome nearby as many refugees from a large crisis or something like that. So other members of the international community may need to help. So I think that that's fine when it comes to, especially to legal immigration. When it comes to legal immigration, it says political authorities, for the sake of the common good for which they are responsible, may make the exercise of the right to immigrate subject to various juridical conditions. Immigrants are obliged to respect with gratitude the material and spiritual heritage of the country that receives them, to obey its laws and assist in carrying civic burdens. So what the church teaches is there is a right to migrate. A state can limit that right in accord with the common good. Immigrants must respect the laws of their country, including the laws that prohibit illegal immigration. But if someone engages in illegal immigration, that does not give license to treat them as being subhuman or to unlawfully oppress or exploit them. So, for example, a company would not have a right to coerce an illegal immigrant to work at a job that is highly dangerous or exploitative, knowing that the person is afraid that they will be deported. That would be wrong. So we have these elements together. There has to be a respect for the rule of law when it comes to immigration. The state can regulate immigration when it comes to promoting the common good. But immigrants, whether legal or illegal, have to be treated with respect in accordance with what civilized society and what the gospel requires. So you have all that. I think your concerns fall within what the church teaches. Catholics are going to disagree about how to apply that in certain cases, but that's not the same as the teaching itself in paragraph 2241 of the Catechism.
Claire, if you stay on the line and give your mailing address to Marie, I'm going to send you a copy of our brand new 20 Answers written by our friend Mark Brumley on Catholic social teaching. And there is a section in there giving a similar clear answer to the one that Trent did on what the church does and does not teach on immigration, which is a controversial topic, but the church's teaching on it is clear. Trent, let's even get one more. Let's go to Dan in Pennsylvania watching on YouTube. Dan, thanks for watching on YouTube. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live.
Hey, Chris and Trent.
Hello.
Hey, Chris and Trent, how's it going?
Good.
Dan, you got to be real quick.
So my question is kind of related to IVF.
Sure.
As much as I agree with the Catholic teaching on it, I have tons of Catholic friends and non-Catholic friends who don't, and usually the argument I get from them is that, you know, usually that they'll always say that it's always, because IVF obviously isn't 100%, that they always say that when it works, it is always God's will within it. But I always like look at that and kind of look at it a little differently. But I never know the exact argument to give.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure. So there's, to be brief before we run out of time here, one harm related to IVF is that many embryos are destroyed in the process. That's murder. That's a secondary wrong to IVF. The primary wrong is that it violates a child's right to life often, but it also violates a child's right to be conceived within the body of his mother. And that is the key thing here. A child has a right to be the fruit of the gift of self in the marital act, not as something created in a laboratory by a technician. And so you can point out that if we can create a child in a laboratory, why not just create children from all kinds of sperm and egg for people to, not just for any couple, but just for single parents, the child quickly turns into a commodity rather than as a gift of the spouses. And we see this, it's ugly in the IVF industry, how children are commodified in this way. I cover this in my book, Made This Way, that I would highly recommend. Three chapters on it in Made This Way, if you're interested.
Dan, thanks very much for your call. Trent, thanks very much for your answers and for the convivial 2 hours.
Oh, it was great. Thank you for hosting, Chris.
I love hosting this show. Coming up in 22 hours, 2 hours of open forum with Tim Staples, Director of Apologetics and Evangelization here at Catholic Answers. Keep us in your prayers. See you tomorrow. God bless.